Welcome to Questions in Sustainability, a science-based podcast series that explores programs, people, and ideas in sustainability of food systems. I am Professor Paul Vincelli from the University of Kentucky, and I'm your host today for this discussion. I want to make a note here that we appreciate all of our guests who offer their time and expertise to Questions in Sustainability. And of course, the views expressed by our guests and by yours truly, as a matter of fact, do not necessarily represent those of the University of Kentucky. So with that, let me introduce our guest, Dr. Leonardo Trasandi, who is has an MD and also, I believe, a master's in public policy. Is that right, MPP?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a long list of accolades here in his CV. He's the Jim G. Hendrick MD Professor and Vice Chair in the Department of Pediatrics at New York University School of Medicine. He is the chief of the Division of Environmental Pediatrics, which is very appropriate for this topic today, professor of environmental medicine, professor of population health, associated faculty with NYU's Wagner School of Public Service, associated faculty of NYU's Global Institute of Public Health. Just a phenomenal background, and I'm just thrilled to have you here today, Leo. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm thrilled to be here.
So let me start by asking you to tell something about yourself, just so the audience is able to make some connection to you. It could be how you got into being a physician. Could be how you got into the particular subject today, if you like. Whatever you wish to share.
Sure. So the story of how I got into environmental health is not linear. I started as an applicant to medical school. I was getting a lot of questions in my interviews about the then Clinton healthcare plan. Mm-hmm. This preceded Obamacare and what we have in the present time. And at one point during the interview process, I don't know what I was thinking at the time. I turned around and asked a question. So what do I learn about environmental health? I mean, sorry, not about environmental health, about health policy first in the medical school curriculum to evaluate the Clinton healthcare plan. And on the other end of the interview, this was in person, mind you, was stunned silence. And I didn't get into that medical school. I did okay in my medical school application process, probably because I didn't ask the question that much. But that experience left in me an imprint. It got me thinking, gosh, I went straight from college to medical school. Maybe I should explore my itch and scratch it. Mm. And so I decided to get a master's in public policy and a medical degree at the Kennedy School of Government. Mm. And that experience, I thought at first when I started, would be a nice interlude from the clinical work and rotations and taking care of sick patients. But boy, did my mind open up. I mean, just getting exposed to people who worked at the interface of human rights and politics. I mean, this was in the late 90s at this point. So this was the tail end of the Clinton administration coming into the Bush administration. So, you saw people from different political swaths of life and perspectives, and that was eye-opening too. So I was not reluctant to return to medical school, but definitely of the mindset that I wanted to carve out a career at the interface of medicine and public policy. So I decided to do my pediatric residency at Boston Children's and Boston Medical Center. Great experience, loved pediatrics pretty much from the beginning of medical school and before. So that was pretty much a set pattern for me to proceed. But I was still hungry for health policy, and I knew I needed to get some more experience, and I wanted in-person experience. So I had the privilege of figuring out how to do a health policy fellowship in the office of Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I was told, okay, you can work on children's health policy and environmental health policy. And I figured, okay, I've got the child health policy part down. The environmental stuff I'll figure out. Boy, was I in for a surprise. Mm. I mean, the profound impact of environmental exposures on people's lives, let alone kids' lives, was something I just hadn't seen before. I mean, I had gotten a little bit of lead exposure and air pollution research in medical school, but I didn't, and residency to a lesser extent, but I didn't know that there was this universe of chemical exposures that affected our lives, from pesticides to flame retardants and such. And that really set me on the course that I'm in today, where I am studying environmental exposures, what they do to kids, but to all of us, quite frankly, and trying to translate it into what we can do as policymakers to prevent these exposures in the first place.
Yeah, you have such a wonderful background for this topic. So for the listeners, we're here today to talk about an insecticide. The active ingredient of that insecticide is called chlorpyrifos, and it has been in a number of products used. If you go back far enough, several decades, it used in resonances, but even until this year, it's been a product that's an insecticide that's labeled for use in various crops, including, a few examples: corn, soybeans, broccoli, and apples. Widely used, not so much in Kentucky, to my knowledge, but in some parts of the country, it's been a very widely used insecticide. I'll turn it over to you in just a second, Leo. But I did want to sort of lay the background here that this is an insecticide that has been used widely, and 2015 and thereabouts was a lot of concern was finally hitting the public's attention in terms of its potential hazard to children as well as perhaps other populations. So I know you can give a much better background than I can. Would you share with us something about chlorpyrifos and why was there concern just a few years ago?
So I go even further back when I think about this, in a way, in that you ask yourself, well, why did we even consider these chemicals in the first place? And the backstory here is that these were originally nerve gas agents. In World War II, we used them as combat. And the idea was that you could paralyze people. And what people then realized was, wow, at lower levels, these don't seem to have as much an effect on humans as they do on rodents and other critters. And so all of a sudden there was a recognition, and there's biology behind it. We as humans have a different form of an enzyme in our bodies, acetylcholinesterase. And when you get exposed to very high levels of organophosphate pesticides like chlorpyrifos, you stop the function of acetylcholinesterase and your nerve cells go through too much electrical activity. That's the down and dirty explanation of what these chemicals do. Yeah. And critters seem to be much more sensitive than humans. So the idea was at first, well, we can use these at low levels in homes and in crops and people won't get hurt. Well, fast forward, science started to tell us that our own original notions of only the dose making the thing a poison were not exactly true. And studies started to show us that low levels of exposures of these pesticides in pregnancy did two things. They were associated with decreases in cognitive potential in kids. And then when people looked at why, they realized it was because organophosphorus pesticides at these lower levels of exposure mess with thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone is the growth factor for the fetal brain. It's really what gives us our superpower as humans to learn well in school, to be productive members of the workforce, to be intelligent life, if you will. So you mess with thyroid hormone in pregnancy, you can have cognitive deficits, even autism and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And then it wasn't just the humans that were being identified as being lower IQ when they were exposed in utero to these pesticides. They looked at brain images of kids who were highly exposed, and they saw that these kids had smaller parts of the brain, the frontal and parietal cortex, that matched the deficits on the neuropsychological testing that people had done. And so, unfortunately, there were multiple fingerprints at the scene of the crime.
Yeah, wow. That's a sad fact, but important to hear and know. I did want to mention that, that Dr. Trisandi is the author of a review of this pesticide in PLOS Biology, which is a open access journal. And the title is When Enough Data Are Not Enough to Enact Policy, The Failure to Ban Chlorpyrifos. And so you can get that, download that for yourself. And it's a, and that was actually the reason I contacted him to be a guest on this program. So so there's scientific evidence that you refer to in that paper. And of course, there's been much written about the scientific evidence of the risks. How was this playing out in terms, I mean, if there was evidence of risk, surely we would stop using it, right? I mean,
That's the problem. And companies made a lot of money for many years manufacturing this chemical and using it in a broad array of aspects of agriculture. As you said, corn, soybean. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are big money crops. Yeah. And there's a lot of money and therefore skin in the proverbial game, if you will. And so it's maybe no surprise, though sad, to see people fighting the evidence and suggesting that the government not ban these pesticides in agriculture. Now, the good news is we did that in 2000 for household use. So they stopped using chlorpyrifos in households for critters. And there's a funny thing that happened here, and this is really important because policy predicts exposure. Exposure contributes to disease, and disease ultimately costs us all. So there were a bunch of researchers at Columbia University that were studying a population of kids and moms in northern Manhattan, and they were measuring babies' cord blood before and after this ban. The ban happened in the middle of their study. The levels dropped off the face of the earth after the ban.
The ban in terms of residential use.
Correct. This is just the ban of residential use. We'll come back to agricultural use a little later for sure. But when that really is an important part of this story when it comes to agriculture, because it wasn't as though there wasn't just proof of harm. There was proof of benefit. Because what happened is that the associations of the pesticide with IQ also disappeared in the later kids because they weren't exposed to the toxic pesticide, insecticide. And so fast forward, you know, it seems that if you're talking about household use, the companies didn't seem to have as much ability to fight back that policy change that was good for kids. But when it came to agricultural uses, the companies that make these pesticides and to a lesser extent, maybe other interest groups, one held firm and they kept using these pesticides. And unfortunately, we have a legacy in the United States today where we have a generation of kids who are substantially exposed to these chemicals. And when a child loses an IQ point, maybe I wouldn't notice if it were my kid. Maybe my wife wouldn't notice, no offense to her. The teachers might not notice. My kid's doctors might not notice. But if 100,000 kids lose an IQ point, the entire economy notices. And that's because each child's IQ point is roughly worth 2% of a child's lifetime economic productivity. So each IQ point in a kid is worth $20,000. 4 million kids born each year. That's a lot of zeros that start to pile up. And so the cost of organophosphorus pesticides in the U.S. is still, based on the most recent estimates, $47 billion each year. Because there are hundreds of thousands of children who lose IQ points as a result. And I know I keep going back to policy, but there was some progress in limiting these exposures in agriculture due to a law called the Food Quality Protection Act. And you know, this is one of the reasons I'm proud to be an American, is that in Europe, they didn't ban these pesticides as rigorously in kids because they required, the U.S. required safe, additional safety factors for kids in the Food Quality Protection Act. But the European Union didn't implement anything similar. You look at the data in Europe, and the story's even worse. The costs of these exposures in Europe are 121 billion euro. Now, a euro is a little bit bigger than a dollar, but if you just equate dollars and euros for a minute, you can see it's about a threefold difference in costs in Europe. And that's because they kept using this pesticide that was toxic to the developing brains of kids. So again, that's the importance of policy. Mm-hmm. And that's the, and this is what happens when companies stop and intervene and fail to protect kids from toxic exposures.
Sure. So the figures you've given have to do with impacts of the organophosphates, not
that's right,
just chlorpyrifos, but the family of insecticides. Okay,
absolutely. Good. That is the one, you know, asterisk you can put by the analyses is that most of the studies use these measures in urine of dialkyl phosphate pesticides, which are the broader class of mm-hmm. chemicals in which organophosphorus pesticides live, or insecticides
yeah.
live.
Yeah, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm an agricultural scientist. I've done a lot of work with plant disease control. I'm not anti-pesticide, but I will say that what was most important to me about this circumstance, this case with chlorpyrifos, is because it was the first time that I had witnessed, you know, we're going back into the mid, what was it, 2014, 2015, 16, in that range.
Right.
There were several reports from EPA, and EPA scientists wanted to ban this pesticide, as I understood it. And we did not, as a society. There was no policy to ban it. It was the first time I'd ever seen I've probably been working with pesticides in the field for 30 something years. And maybe more. And EPA scientists were saying, ban it. Here's the evidence to ban it. This is not safe for kids. And we weren't banning it as a country. That was really shocking to me. And so maybe you could comment about that aspect.
Yeah, we should be shocked. I mean, and you know, this is not a, that part of the story is not a good moment. I mean, we were doing the right thing, as I was alluding to, in the late 1990s, when the federal government, this is a unanimous law passed through Congress, requiring this additional safety factor for kids through the Food Quality Protection Act. Then fast forward about another decade later, and the industry is fighting tooth and nail for this chemical over and above kids' health. It's like the chemical obtained an identity as a human. Or as a company almost on its own, you know, in combat with kids' health. I mean, that's never really the philosophy that people have who are walking around the street every day. I mean, I think a chemical would have an inferior status to a human being, but no, and we clearly give corporate entities that kind of power.
Yeah. So,
and that power undermines, you know, academic scientists and their work, and it undermines decisions that, you know, federal government and state government scientists who are just trying to do the right thing. They're trying to weigh the evidence and be about science.
Yeah. Well, we sort of reached the point in the interview where it really we're going to. You know, get into some of the, what does this mean? What are some of the lessons and so on? And maybe a quote or two that I've selected out of your paper to hear more about that. So, but what I'd like to do at this point is take a short musical interlude. And I do that for a couple of reasons. I'm explaining this for the listeners, Leo, as well as you, as much as you. I'd like to put in a couple minutes of music to refresh the mind, help restore full attention. I know it helps me. And And besides, I chose a beautiful waltz, an achingly beautiful waltz for this this interlude. And so I want to share it with listeners, and it actually relates to the topic for me. So maybe I'll say more about that later. But with that, we're speaking with Dr. Leo Trisandi from New York University, and he's a pediatrician and policy expert. And we're talking about the insecticide chlorpyrifos and the health risks to children in particular that insecticide poses. Now, it has been set to be banned, or is banned, and just there's maybe grandfather use of it going on. The problem has been resolved, but there's some lessons that we can learn from this, and we'll talk about those when we come back. And we're back. You're listening to the podcast Questions in Sustainability. I'm Paul Vincelli, your host, and I'm from the University of Kentucky. And our guest today is Dr. Leo Trisandi. He is an expert in, he's a pediatrician, so he's an expert in children's health, but also an expert in policy and pesticide use. And so it's a pleasure to have you join us today, Leo. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Now, there's a quote out of your paper published in 2017 during some of the most controversial moments in this debate over chlorpyrifos and whether or not it should be used. And you referred to dismissal of scientific evidence and attacks on scientific norms. And I can certainly talk about those in the context of the paper. I've read it several times, but assigned it to graduate students. But this is your work, so tell us something about what you're referring to in those cases.
Well, we picked up on this a little bit in the first part of the program, but just to amplify a little bit more and reinforce it, the way you go about studying and eventually regulating chemicals is that when there's data, you act on data. And maybe there's debate about when is enough evidence to act. When do you say when? Mm-hmm. But you don't simply throw up your hands and say that the science is fake. And in many ways with chlorpyrifos, there was active flaunting of the science that was there over the past 4 years. And it's a sad day in science. And, you know, talking to you about chlorpyrifos now that we're in the middle of a pandemic, 19 months in, or whatever many months we're in, it's a bit jarring to think about, because I think you could say the same thing about some of the science around infections of COVID, whether you wear a mask, whether you get a vaccine and the like, whether you bring kids back into school when you quarantine and such. And the evidence for the effects of chlorpyrifos on the developing brains of kids could not have been more well aligned. You had three and now eventually four cohorts, independent observations from different populations showing adverse effects on cognition in kids. You had images of the brains of the same kids with smaller parts of the brains. You had two different independent verifications in the case of one cohort of those cohorts. And then you had a mechanism by which you knew these chemicals could do what the chemical was being shown to do. So we talk in academic public health and in public health in general about what is enough evidence for what we call causality. And I don't want to get into this notion of perfect causality, because there is no such thing. Mm-hmm. It's really, you have enough information and you decide what you weigh that against the stakes on both sides. And you make a conscious public decision. So there's a role there for policymaking and input. But, you know, the irony is that the criteria for setting up causality were described by Sir Austin Bradford Hill, a British public health scientist, during the tobacco wars. Mm-hmm. And that's why it was inspired. We were having much the same debates we had about chlorpyrifos that we're having about vaccines and COVID and some such. When he elaborated these criteria for deciding whether something is sufficient to act. Now, over the years, that's been manipulated and abused to almost assume that you have to have a randomized controlled trial to determine whether something is bad or good for you. The problem with that is that in environmental exposures like pesticides, you can't ethically intentionally give people a pesticide and see if they have an effect. So you have to rely on observational evidence. But even still, with that flaw in what the field has to face, regardless of when it comes to environmental hazards, there were multiple observational studies showing the same signal. There was a mechanism. There was brain damage literally being shown in kids. And yet policymakers wouldn't listen. They didn't even want to hear it. And that was purely because of financial motives. And the irony, as we talked about earlier in the program, is this failure cost us as a society. I like to say that Adam Smith, the father of modern economics, was an environmentalist at heart. And that's because when you have toxic effects from environmental hazards like pesticides, like chlorpyrifos, you have economic damages being inflicted on people who neither buy nor sell the pesticide in the first place. Those are called market externalities. And these damages mean that the pesticide is overproduced compared to the societally optimal amount and is sold at a lower cost than the true societal cost. So Adam Smith would say that's a market that's not functioning right. Hmm. So he would say you have to undo market externalities. And in essence, that means Adam Smith was a bit of an environmentalist, even though we think of him as an economist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so one of the phrases that stuck with me out of, you know, you referred to, what was the name? Hill, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was the quote that stuck out for me, you know, referring to causality and all that. But there was another one, and that was the word pseudoscience. And
right,
a trade association representative responded to the estimates of disease that were being published by referring to it as pseudoscience. And I found that rather offensive, even though I wasn't a principal in the debate, because, you know, I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen who are listening, competent scientists are never swayed by name calling. So, so it might have had an impact on the public to hear that being called pseudoscience, but that is absolutely very, just very poor policy. And again, what was at stake was the health of children. So, that was upsetting. Now, this represents maybe an opportunity, Leo, for you to speak to agricultural scientists and agricultural practitioners, because that's the world I occupy. And, mm-hmm. I'll certainly have some listen in, and hopefully as many as possible. And what take-home lessons do you see from this experience and other experiences you've had in the field of public policy and environmental health?
Yeah, so first of all, I'm not a person that has a vendetta against pesticides in general. There are, let's think about malaria in certain endemic parts of Africa. The trade-offs might be different. Now we have a vaccine on the way, thank goodness.
Yes.
But that's tremendous. But before there was a vaccine, the only option in some settings was to use pesticides to kill off the malaria.
That's right.
Because malaria is a fatal disease and it was endemic across the world. So everything here has a trade-off. So I just want the folks listening to hear from me that I'm not one of these, I'm not trying to take us back to the 1740s and have us be a chemical, a synthetic chemical-free society either. I'm just talking about having the trade-offs really laid out in a careful way and having proactive assessment of these chemicals and their potential hazards and really weighing out the trade-offs in a transparent way and then reassessing it and deciding what to do. What we're talking about with this name-calling of pseudoscience and, these other activities that industry tries to do, it's classically called manufactured doubt. And, this is where I do come back to when Bradford Hill was writing his essay on causality, because to be perfectly candid, it's the same playbook the tobacco companies were using that we're seeing today. They were calling the scientists that were warning people about the health effects of tobacco pseudoscience back then. They were trying to publish alternative viewpoints, sometimes ghostwriting them for people who were willing to have their names attached to the work. All of these tricks are in the playbook of the companies that are with the incentive or have the incentive to report something that's favorable to their ongoing sales of products. And so if there's anything that I can communicate is to listen for potential conflicts of interest and the impacts of conflicts of interest on science in particular. Now, am I to say that there's never a situation that industry scientists shouldn't have input? I'm not saying that. Mm-hmm. But I am saying we have to take that input with a grain of salt and understand why people might be saying what they're saying and the implications for whether it's accurate or not, or should really inform policymaking or not. That's really the main message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, these are very good points, and I appreciate the way you see the malaria issue and how that has been for many people as justifiable use of pesticides. And so it's wonderful to hear the nuance that you see in that situation. So another population I hope will pick up this program is students and students from from at any grade at any level. What thoughts do you have for them?
So I have a lot of hope. I mean, we've talked a lot about companies and manufactured doubt and chemicals being used without their proof of safety, that we're undergoing a dangerous and unnatural experiment. But here's why I have so much hope, because I've seen so much transformation on the climate change debate because of the younger generations in particular. and I'm not that old. I'm not that I'm trying to put myself into a different age epoch than I am. But I'm not a millennial, and I'm not a Generation Z, but I see the gusto in which they've taken on the movement and the understanding that environmental factors can impact their lives in a profound way. And it's no secret that these chemicals, we're talking about pesticides, flame retardants, aluminum can linings, thermal paper receipts, can the ones that disrupt hormones, things in plastics, they are often coming from petrochemical stock. And petrochemicals are driving climate change. So there's two really main takeaways there. One is that if you combat climate change, you do indirectly reduce exposure to toxic chemicals in the environment that we're talking about. But you need both, and they go hand in hand. Because if you cool the planet and don't address endocrine disruptive chemicals, you'll have a society that will be poisoned with consequences of its inability to contribute to the growth of the next generation. You know, it's no secret that these, for example, pesticides themselves are carcinogens. There are studies that have associated exposure through diet with cancers in some cases. There are effects on fertility that have been described with some of the other chemicals, including pesticides, with less consistency as some of the brain effects we talked about. So this isn't just affecting kids' health. This is affecting all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's very interesting. And hope is that certainly rang through. I appreciate that. Anything else you wish to say before we close?
No, I think we covered it pretty well. Thank you.
Good. Thanks, Leo. So once again, we've been speaking with Dr. Leo Trisandi from New York University, pediatrician and expert in public policy. And I want to say just a word about the waltz that I chose. It's for this program. It's an achingly melancholic waltz. And, you know, I thought it resonated with me because the story of Chlorpyrifos, you know, has a certain degree of sadness to it. It's about protecting kids. But you've brought in this point about hope, and and used climate change as a wonderful example. So we'll keep that in mind. That's a very good way to end. And I do want to say thanks to Rodney Miller and Air Dance for the use of the waltz that I'm playing, the second half of which I'm playing here on our program. And Leo, thanks again. Appreciate it very much.
It was a pleasure being here. Thank you so much.
Take care.
You too.